This section of the Gospel of John follows on the heels of the introduction of Jesus. And John, in his entire book, has seven miracles. And they're all given for the purpose of showing us who Jesus Christ is and showing us that he is Jesus the Christ, the Son of God, and that anyone who believes on him has eternal life, John 20 and verses 30 and 31. So these miracles are separated throughout the book, and the first one is this one right here, turning water into wine. Did you ever find yourself in a tough situation and you know, intellectually, you know, well, God is in control. Everything's fine. Now, this is a little autobiographical, if you please. Where's God in this? What's God going to get out of this? How can any good come out of this? And yet you say, I know it does. God works all things together for good to those who love him, to those who are the called according to his purpose. So it's hard not to say, wait a minute, what is it? And it doesn't have to be a large problem. Small problems. If my car blows an engine, oh, okay, I'll get another engine. I'll get another car or whatever. But that just, it happens. But if I get a flat tire in a bad time, or I run out of gas, especially since that's my biggest problem, it's the biggest part of my problem, it's the little things that eat at you. That's why the word tells us that the little foxes spoil the vines. That's it. The little things peck at you. In a sense, this is one of those little peck at you things. In this passage, Jesus goes to a celebration. In verse 1 it says, and the third day there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee. Now, the third day, as near as I can tell, doesn't have any particular meaning. When I was in the seminary, a pastor came to me, and he was really an evangelist, but he had a group with him, and they had a nice church. He came to my house one night and said, hey, I understand you're a seminary student. Yeah. I said, would you come and teach my people? I'm an evangelist. I get people together. You teach them. So I did that, and I taught Sunday school class there for 4 years. And I noticed sometimes that the pastor, he'd see the word three. Oh, 3 days, that's the resurrection. No matter where the context was, isn't that right? And he'd look over at me and say, right? That's it. No, not necessarily, brother. But this third day, it just means it's the third day after this two-day trip from Bethany in Judea up to the northern part into Cana of Galilee. Cana was near Jesus' home, Nazareth. That's his boyhood home. He performs the first miracle. Now, listen, the miracles, seven miracles who are supposed to teach the nation that Jesus Christ, this is Jesus the Christ, the Son of God. Where is he going to do his first miracle? Way up in the corner somewhere, a little town. Why? Well, that's the start. That's where he lived, and that's where he began. But later on, he'll get down to Judea and into Jerusalem, and he'll give them that. But here he is in this little town, a long way from Jerusalem. And verse 1 says, and the mother of Jesus was there. Now, this probably indicates that she was a relative, and she was doing a part of the wedding feast. And she was helping in some way. And she may even have been the responsible person, as we'll see in a little bit. So she was there, and then Jesus was called. Jesus and his disciples had been invited previously, and they had accepted the invitation, apparently. And this verse 2 says, now Jesus had been invited to the wedding, and his disciples. So if Mary was a relative, he was a relative too. So he was a relative of the family, those who were being married. He was really, it seemed like an honored guest here. And at that time, Jesus didn't have 12 disciples, by the way. He only had 5 or 6. So they weren't responsible for the wine shortage, as we'll see later. But they knew he was coming. They knew who was going to come with him. So no problem there. And then a little thing in here that comes in, I think. Jesus is at a celebration. When we first see John the Baptist, where is he? Out in the wilderness. What's he eating? Well, locust and wild honey. How's he dressed? Well, he's dressed with an old camel skin on his head, on him, and he's out there preaching in the wilderness. And everybody, all Jerusalem, Judea, went out to see him. There he was. What a contrast between that and Jesus in the celebration of a wedding. So he was at the celebration. And then Jesus has a question put to him in verses 3 to 5. There was a problem. And when they ran out of wine at a festival, at a wedding, that is a no-no for Paul. You can't do that. It wasn't Jesus' fault, wasn't the disciples' fault. But whatever the reason, they had run out of wine. Proposal of Jesus' mother is seen in verse 3. And the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." Now, John doesn't call the mother of Jesus Mary anywhere in the epistle. He doesn't call himself John, that disciple whom Jesus loved, but he never says his name John, never says Jesus' mother's name Mary. Doesn't mention the. So he says, the mother of Jesus said to Jesus, "They have no wine." Now, she didn't explicitly ask him for a miracle, although verse 4 seems to say that's what she expected. But she's not asking for a miracle here explicitly. She explained the situation, and just to make known what's happening here. And that's a proper procedure, isn't it? If you're going to pray for something, if you're going to ask for something from God, how do you do it? Well, Philippians 4:6 says, "Be anxious for nothing, but in everything, by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God." That's the way we approach God with a problem. She approached Jesus that way. Her implication seems to be that she wanted Jesus to do something. What? I don't know, but she wanted to do something. Apparently get some wine some way. It's like Mary in chapter 11, in the context of that seventh miracle. Lazarus, remember the raising of Lazarus? Lazarus was sick, and so the sister sent word to Jesus saying, "Lord, behold, he whom you love is sick. Didn't say, "Oh, come and do it." Just said, "He's sick, and we'll leave it up to you what you do." And I find myself doing the same thing with God. I say, "Lord, here's a problem. And here's what I think you ought to do. Do this and this." No, God, do what you want. I'm just telling you what the need is. Let your request be made known to God in a situation like that. So when Jesus finally got to Lazarus' place, Lazarus was already dead. And Martha went to him and said, "Lord, if you had been there, my brother would not have died." She was really chastising him a little bit. So the same thing is true here. Mary is simply telling Jesus the problem. "We have a problem here. Do something about it." And it seems that she's hinting at a miracle. Do a miracle. Bring some wine in. So that's the problem and the proposal. Do something. Now, Jesus' prerogative is seen in verses 4 and 5. Jesus said to her, "Woman, what does your concern have to do with me?" I'm not really keen on that translation. Literally, here's what he says. "What to me and to you?" So you have to make something out of it. And it seems to be as, what concern is that of you and me? That's not our problem. And he says, "Woman." What is that, woman? What does that have to do with you and me? Well, the word "woman" there is not derogatory. In John 19, Jesus is hanging on the cross, and he turns and he sees his mother and John standing there, and he says to Mary, "Woman, behold your son." Then to John, "Behold your mother." But he uses the word woman. It's not bad. I used to know a fellow, I was in college with him, and he used to call his wife woman. "That's my woman." That doesn't sound very good here. And we shouldn't write that back into this section. It's not derogatory at all. Then his mother said to the servants, "Whatever he says to you, do it." This shows, I think, that had the authority there, that all the servants did what she said do. And so apparently she was in charge of the whole thing. And do whatever it takes. Whatever he says, do it. So Jesus was at the celebration, and he heard the question. We have no, what about wine? And then Jesus and the solution. The immediate purpose. He did what he did for a purpose. Always does. God always does things for a purpose. The purpose is there, whether you can read it or not, in your problem. God will use what you have. I like this verse 6. Jesus didn't bring wine down from heaven. He didn't have it sprinkled all over everybody, or everybody's glass was filled up and wouldn't, none of that. He starts off with whatever you have. Remember Moses in the wilderness? Backside of the desert, and God calls him, "Go and deliver my people from Egypt." Okay, go down and tell Pharaoh, "Let my people go." And Moses said, "Who, me? How am I going to do that?" And God said to him, "What is that in your hand?" "Well, you're not going to get something special for me? You're not going to bring me a whole army or whatever?" "No, what's that in your hand?" What you have is what you need. "What is that?" "Well, it was a staff, remember?" And he said, "It's a staff? Well, throw it down on the ground." Threw it down on the ground. It became a serpent. Poisonous serpent. Then he said, "Reach down and touch that. Grab it by the tail." Grab it by the tail, and it became a staff again. So he's saying, what you have is what you need. That staff will do it. What did he do with that staff? He did a lot of things. But one thing I can remember especially, he stood by the Red Sea, raised the staff. He said to the people, "Observe the work of the Lord." Raised the staff, and whoosh, there's a pathway to go right through. Oh, that's it. What's that in your hand? The thing that you have, the problem that is on your mind, what's that in your hand? Do what you can do. Look around for what you have. And so they looked around. There were 6 water pots of stone, according to the manner of purification of the Jews, with a capacity of 20 to 30 gallons apiece. There were how many? 6. 6 water pots of, if it's only 20, 120. 120 gallons of wine goes a long way. And if it's 30, you do the math. Well, they had not used that those things for wine before, apparently. They were water pots. And so it seems to me, if you stick with Jesus, he's going to give you a lot of things that you haven't done before. Just follow him. Find out what you have, and then do what Jesus says do. But he won't do it for you. Interesting. Jesus said to them, "You fill the water pots with water." And they filled them to the brim. And it seems to me that sometimes when we pray, we say, "Lord, take care of this problem," and then we forget it. "Oh, God's going to take care of it." No, not necessarily. You'll say, "What's in your hand?" Then he's going to say, now do it, use it, and I'll show you how. So he's they did it, they drew it out. So God will use what you have, and God will not do it for you, and he may surprise you with the results. Then verse 9 says, when the toastmaster of the feast had tasted the water that had been made wine and did not know where it came from, and then a little parenthesis, but the servants knew, and the master of the feast called the bridegroom and said to him, every man serves the good wine first, and when the people have drunk freely, then he serves the poor wine, but you have kept the good wine until now. One thing, this is wine. We're not talking about grape juice. There's a good word for grape juice in Acts 1, Acts 2. He says, these people are drunk on grape juice. When the Holy Spirit came, remember? They're drunk on, that was sweet wine, a sweet grape juice. And they were making fun of them. Well, this is not that. This is wine. You know, it's wine. And so it was that. And he says, when we ran out, but the wine now is better than the previous one. So then he tells a little trick. You usually put the good wine out first, and then after the people have drunk, give them whatever they want. They don't know what it is. I think that's what he's saying. So it was a surprise, a great, wonderful surprise that he had done the very best. Give them the very best wine. So that was the immediate purpose, get the wine. But the second purpose, verse 11, the main purpose, I take it, this beginning of signs Jesus did in Cana of Galilee and manifest his glory. You learn something about Jesus. It seems to me that if we're going to ask Jesus to do something and he's going to do it through us and with us and by us, if you're going to do that, then we ought to say, wait a minute, what does he want me to learn out of this? That is the most important aspect of the whole thing. He manifests his glory. And question, let me ask you a question. When Jesus, or when God created man, why didn't he create him so he could not sin? Why go through all this thing of man sinning and Jesus coming and dying and all that kind of thing and people going to hell? Why have all that? Why not at the Garden of Eden create a man who could not sin? And the wife being made out of his rib, she could not sin either. So nobody can sin. Boy, you could save a lot of time. 3,000 or 4,000 years. Why not? Well, go back to when the angels fell. Angels, a third of the angels, followed after Satan. He was trying to make himself bigger than God, and these had got the angels to go with him. And they fell, and what did God do? Well, now, I'll help you out. You'll be all right. No. He threw them out of hell, out of heaven, and made a place in hell for them. Well, why did he do that? What did we learn from God's punishment of the angels? We learn that God is holy. God does not accept sin. So we learn something there. That's not much. So when Adam sinned, and then God began to reveal more about himself. See, that's what God is trying to do. He's trying to reveal himself to his creatures. And we learn about the grace of God. We learn about the goodness of God. Learn about the love of God, the kindness of God, and all the way down from the beginning, way over here at the creation, Adam and Eve sin, and then we learn something about God's grace, God's goodness, and so forth. And then later on we find somebody might say, well, yeah, you're doing all of that, but you're not telling us what to do. When I do something and then you give me a crack on the knuckles or whatever. So if you just tell me what to do. I was dean of students in a college for a while, and some of the students would think, if you'll just tell us what you want us to do, we'll do it. Well, that doesn't work, because God said, when mankind said, what shall we do? Tell us what to do. He said, okay, here it is, the law. Keep that. We can't keep that. They made out they could. They thought they could. No, they couldn't do that. And then God came along with Jesus Christ and comes in grace. And grace, so different times. All through the history of man, God is teaching. You know what? There's going to be 1,000-year span. If Satan caused Eve to sin and Adam to sin, and all that sin comes in through, and Satan's in there, well, what are you going to say? The devil made me do it. Right. It wasn't me. The devil made me do it. During the 1,000-year reign of Christ, guess where the devil is? In the pit. He can't touch people. And God is left after the 1,000-year. What happens way down here at the end? 1,000-year reign of Christ. Men rebel. Millions, billions will be rebelling at the end. Well, who did that? It wasn't Satan. It was man himself. And so when all through this, he's teaching about it, he's showing himself to be faithful, to be holy, of course, to be faithful, to be loving, to be kind, all that, he's revealing himself. So that in the end, after he has taken people who have believed on Jesus and made them his, then they will be at the end ready to say, all right, I'll worship God. And they'll worship the God that they've seen all through this time. This is an amazing thing, it seems to me. But Jesus has the solution. Now, what do we learn then? We learn that God is a holy God, but God is a loving God. God is a trustful, trustworthy God. All that we learn by experience. Now, he says at the end of that verse, his disciples believed in him. Now, they had believed in him. They were disciples. They were believers. But they believed even more deeply here because of this one problem that was solved. So Jesus and the celebration, Jesus and the question, Jesus and the solution. Now, Jesus and the relocation. Verse 12. And after this, he went down to Capernaum. He and his mother and his brothers and his disciples. They stayed there a few days. Now, Capernaum then became Jesus' home. No more in Nazareth. And apparently his family was estranged from him as well. They tried to get him one time. They thought he was out of his mind. Oh, come on, let's go home. We'll take care of you. Well, it just seems that the family was also estranged from him. And his hometown, Nazareth, as we'll see later on in the book. Well, what shall we say? The problem was solved. Sometimes the answer comes fast. Sometimes it comes more slowly. And sometimes there's silence. Sometimes it's fast. Sometimes it's easy. Sometimes it's painful. But the answer comes. Now, no Andre Crouch. Through it all is where he's one of his hymns, many hymns. Well, that's one of them. He says, I thank God for the mountain. I thank God for the valley. I thank him for the storms he's brought me through. If I never had a problem, I'd never know he could solve them. I'd never know what faith in God could do. Through it all, I've learned to trust in Jesus. I've learned to trust in God. Through it all, I've learned to depend on His Word. And this is one of the points, I think, of the passage. It's my main point. That is, that I've learned to depend on His Word. The living Word, of course, Jesus. The written Word, the Word that He gave. And our faith can find a resting place in that Word.